Welcome to another day on WPR, where it's never just another day. As a matter of fact, each day and each hour is unique and brand new. Such an hour is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Today, we continue our radio trek around western Wisconsin in search of what makes up the arts, culture, and humanities where we live. This week, it's calling all young writers. Next Thursday, the 12th, it's your opportunity, if you're in grades 7 to 12, to give your words some daylight, some volume at the Writers Read event at the Public Library in Eau Claire. Max Garland is here with details. Saturday, October 14th, the second literary crawl unfolds in River Falls. Yet another chance to hear those who write it also read and recite it. Participant Robin Bowles is our guest on that topic. In addition to listing what's on stage in western Wisconsin, Jim Oliver greets Robert Coulson, director of The Foreigner, nearing final rehearsals involving the Menominee Theater Guild. And let's begin this edition of Spectrum West with a question. Quick, what's one of the nicest things about living in a region among good people with a positive perspective on what it takes to make life better for us all? You're right, it's taking care of each other, especially when any of us truly can use the help. Your moccasins become my moccasins, and we get to work. That's the way it is at the Feed My People Food Bank, where every month is special, but this month is extra so, as Assistant Director Suzanne Becker will testify. I need to know what an assistance director does. I know the word assistance, so I can use my imagination, but...
You know, I do a little bit of everything. I oversee development and communications, also programming and our partners, so our field services. We have about 125 partners.
Yes, no kidding. That's impressive.
Yeah.
In how many counties? I've said it before.
14.
14. West and northwest?
West Central. We go up as up to Washburn, down Buffalo. So
how is that coordinating with 125 partners?
Well, they're wonderful people, of course.
I'm sure.
They are. It gets harder the farther away they are, Washburn and Sawyer, and, you know, the population is much more dispersed, but there's tremendous need.
Logistics.
Logistics, right.
That's tough.
But we have six trucks now.
Wow.
So we,
big trucks?
A semi and then five box trucks. They go out throughout the whole 14 counties. We have free delivery to all the agencies.
You do?
Yeah, but we have to work harder at some of those counties because it's obviously more difficult than reaching Eau Claire.
Well, statistics is what I wanted to talk about to begin with. People probably don't realize, and when I say people, it's those of us who don't wonder where food is going to come from, or even a more stark comparison, those who have, use, or waste more food than they need. Mm-hmm. They don't realize how many people right here, up and down western Wisconsin, are actually what is called food insecure. What is that?
Food insecure means there are times when I might not know when my next meal is coming, or if I might know, but I might know that I'm not going to have enough.
The USDA actually has a definition of food insecure. Let me read it. I'm sure, it mirrors what you just said. It refers to USDA's measure of lack of access at times to enough food for an active, healthy life for all household members, limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate foods. Food insecure households are not necessarily food insecure all the time.
That's right.
So statistics for our neck of the woods, how many people in our midst are food insecure?
1 in 9 individuals are food insecure. That number is 1 in 5 when we talk about kids.
You know, I saw those and I thought, okay, more than 10% of everyone and 20% of kids. That's surprising to me.
It's surprising to me, too.
And
number has stayed that way for quite some time. Economy goes up and down, but we know that those that are food insecure and struggling, they feel the struggles deeper, and the better economy has not reached everybody. We have a lot of working poor in our area, a lot who have jobs, but they're living on the fringes, and one thing might throw them over the edge, you know, a hospital bill or a broken down car. You know, and all of a sudden they need to make some choices, you know, and sometimes the food budget hurts.
Decisions, right? Tough decisions.
Right. The face of hunger has changed, I think, because there are so many working poor out there. And oftentimes we know that those who are suffering real poverty, real deep poverty, they qualify for more government assistance. Those who are food insecure, those the working poor, often don't. So they actually may be struggling more than those who are suffering poverty.
Is food insecurity a modern problem, or is this just a modern version of what's always been around?
Yeah, I think it's always been around. Yeah. We just measure it now. We've gone beyond poverty to measure.
We're a lot better at this than we once were?
A lot better at
trying to assist food insecurity?
We'd like to think we are. We certainly have a lot more partners. We have a lot more who are serving niches, trying to reach out to certain populations.
Mm-hmm.
We're certainly trying to have better food, healthier food, that yeah. kind of thing.
There seem to be food banks in every town of almost every size.
And the rural areas are tougher, right? We're working with a place in Fairchild right now. There's a lot of poverty in that area, and they don't have a food pantry. We're trying to go into that community, trying to find a champion. Somebody will help us out to be there on the ground, boots on the ground.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the rural areas that they're tough areas.
Enjoying the company of Suzanne Becker. She's Assistant Director, Feed My People Food Bank. We have some exciting news to tell you about their 35th anniversary, where you can triple your impact. So I've always wondered, and I bet you a lot of other people do too, are food pantries able to take food from restaurants that isn't used, and are we recycling?
The USDA says that 40% of food in our country is wasted, which would more than feed everybody who is food insecure or in poverty. We are working on that every day, and there is quite a network that rescues that food. About 85% of the food that goes through Feed My People is rescued food, food that would otherwise have gone into a landfill. Mm. And that comes from different ways. That comes from retail, grocery stores, and that comes from corporations, different ways.
I remember hearing about the Clean Plate Club during the Second World War. It drives me nuts when I see people saying to a waitress, "No, I'm finished. It was hardly touched." And I don't say that we should stuff ourselves, but take the doggy bag home.
Right, or order less to start with.
But we also buy too much when we go to the grocery store.
Right.
How often every week when the garbage man comes do we take stuff out of the produce bin?
Well, and you know, produce is expensive.
Yeah.
If I'm food insecure, then I'm probably going to walk right by that produce aisle because that's expensive stuff. I'm going to
get it's the healthy stuff.
The healthy stuff, that's right. And I'm going to try to get as many calories as I can for my dollar. Yeah, to waste the produce, that's tough.
It has a shelf life.
Absolutely.
It's what we throw produce out more than anything else, do you
produce
think?
Produce and dairy. Those are things that are hard to handle for our food pantries because they're so perishable.
How do you fill your shelves? You take donations of all kinds, non-perishable foods.
We do.
But you also, with your monetary donations, you buy stuff.
We do work, again, with the coalition. We get semi-trucks of food 3 times a week. We get Walmart trucks. They're a big rescue retail partner of ours.
Good.
We work with local farmers. We work with other grocery stores, too.
So the big trucks that come from retailers, is that stuff that, what, they overordered? It's close to being outdated? What?
It's a lot of produce that's getting close to
okay.
the end of its life. So we obviously have to receive that and get it back out again really quickly. Sometimes it's just something they're not selling. It's a lot of different things. Mostly it's the produce. The produce is fine.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's got blemishes. Sometimes it's odd-shaped. We'll get shipments of milk that have, you know, maybe 3-4 days of life on it, and they know they're not going to sell that. But we can get it out today, tomorrow. A lot of food is good well past its date.
Okay.
I mean, milk is a tough one. That doesn't go too far past its date.
For every $1 donated, you're able to provide how many meals? That's impressive.
Four.
Four meals.
Yeah.
For every dollar.
Right. It's a complicated calculation, but it's USDA and cost of a meal and so forth. And that's why financial donations are so important.
And now during October and your 35th anniversary, that four meals becomes 12. Tell us about that.
We're very excited. We have a group of 6 community supporters.
Mm-hmm.
A few of them were original members of Feed My People. We're trying to get 35,000 in 35 days. For our 35th anniversary.
$35,000.
Yes. And then that $35,000 will be doubled. Very generous. A lot of people love the match. They like to feel like their dollars are being stretched further. Mm-hmm. So we're very optimistic that this will be successful.
How do we get involved in this match? How do we make that happen by the end of October?
You bet. Our website, FMP, like Feed My People, FMPfoodbank.org.
Mm-hmm.
You can go there. You can give online. You can send in a check. You can stop out and see us. Come and get a tour or give us a call,
uh-huh.
and we can talk to people too.
People are cleaning out their pantries, their cupboards. They have non-perishable items. You take that kind of stuff at all times?
You bet. Financial donations allow us to go farther, but it's wonderful to have those too. It provides different variety to folks. So either way.
Not only was it impressive that you have around 125 partners, but all the millions of pounds of stuff that you ship out.
Last year, it was about 7.6 million pounds of food. Of that, about 2.5 million was produce, fresh food. And of those 125 partners, they run about 220 programs. So many of them run more than one. They might do a pantry and a child's backpack program. We have a whole number of direct programs. We have our weekend kids meal program that comes right out of the warehouse. It serves nearly 2,000 kids each week in Eau Claire and Chippewa.
Because you're big brother and you distribute to all of these places, this radio signal is large. People are listening all over western and northwestern Wisconsin. They want to get involved with their local food pantry. Does a donation to their local food pantry help out what you're doing?
You know, we're only as effective as our partners are.
Okay.
So we support them wholeheartedly and absolutely. They are all in need of resources. They're all in need of financial resources, volunteers. That's always important. And so we absolutely encourage that.
Okay.
Whether you choose to donate to Feed My People or directly to one of those food pantries, it's all important. And we look at our 14 counties all the time, try to find the areas that are so underserved and see what we can do.
The website again is fmpfoodbank.org. Suzanne Becker, thanks for being with us and good luck meeting these goals and exceeding these goals in October.
Thank you. We're excited to celebrate the 35 years, and we're so grateful for our community who've supported us.
It's vital to recognize these things don't run themselves. While we talk dollars and cents and pounds and numbers, it's still the human factor that's most important. So donating time to the food bank or your local food pantry is what's needed at the front end. After all, the term helping hand refers to a physical appendage designed for all sorts of good things. A guy who knows a thing or two about writing encourages young people to believe in their words. River Falls prepares their annual downtown literary event. And next, a timeless play, The Foreigner, gets ready to open in our neighborhood on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Simply Done in Downsville, offering fair trade gifts and a space for meetings, retreats, or classes in their historic schoolhouse overlooking the Red Cedar Valley. Simply-dunn.com. Support also comes from Visit Winona, offering Picasso to canoeing to jazz. The city has a wide assortment of entertainment options. A trip planner and events calendar available at visitwinona.com. Now, Jim Oliver recovered nicely from last week's temporary malady. He would like us to meet a guest who has a nice vantage point from which to not only talk about, but also participate in yet another classic theatrical production.
The Foreigner is a comedy by American playwright Larry Hsu. Following its premiere at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater in 1983, the play opened off Broadway in 1984 at New York City's Astor Place Theater, where it ran for 686 performances. The play eventually won 2 Obie Awards and 2 Outer Critics Circle Awards, including Best New American Play and Best Off-Broadway Production. The Menominee Theater Guild production of The Foreigner will open Friday, October 13th, and continue the following weekend through Sunday, October 22nd, at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Joining us by telephone is the director, Robert Colson. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Well, thank you, and you can just call me Bob.
That usually works out pretty well. This isn't your first time around with The Foreigner. Tell us a little bit about your history with the play in Menominee.
Yeah. MTG did this production 25 years ago, I was lucky enough to be in that production and played Ellard Sims, a little half-wit. Don't want to give too much away. And a lot of people on the show said, you know, typecast that apple didn't fall too far from the tree in casting me as Ellard.
Theater people are really very respectful of their co-stars.
Yes, they are. I also have, you know, one other person that was in the cast, Betty, Jean Kusol-Larsen. She was Betty 25 years ago, and she has returned to do another production of The Foreigner with us. So it'll be kind of special that way, too.
Well, given your history with the production, tell us why you pitched the idea of doing this again.
Well, a couple things, I guess. First of all, it is really a well-written, very funny show. Just from an entertainment standpoint, it's worth it just to come and get a look at belly laughing. But the story has a very good storyline. And it's relevant. It's just as relevant today as it was 34 years ago when it opened. It's a satire on racism, on being different, on being a foreigner, and it pokes fun at it in a way that shines a light on being a foreigner, but it also shines even a brighter light on how a community can overcome bigotry and racism. And so from that standpoint, I thought it was time for it to come back. And just given the current political climate and things that are going on, it seems very timely just to revisit this. And unfortunately, the issues of racism, they're still around. They were around 34 years ago when the play was written, and they were around before that, and they are still with us. And so it's a good show to show people just how silly maybe some of this really can be, how serious it is, but that you can really understand and maybe learn a little bit about racism and bigotry and how to overcome it.
Now, you are the director, not an actor, and this is a comedy. But you're taking sort of a serious look at the concept of foreigners in this country. How are you able to make that connection of funny and serious at the same time?
I'm an Air Force brat, and so I grew up all over the world. We were always moving. And so from that standpoint, me and my brothers and my sister, we were always foreigners because we were always starting over and always having to try and fit in. And so I think you realize, you know, the value of humor in trying to break the ice on delicate situations. And this production, it is very serious. And I have a wonderful cast having just a wonderful time doing this. So we're doing it for the entertainment value, but also because it's something that just needs to be thought about and looked at again.
We are talking to Bob Colson, who is director of the Menominee Theater Guild production of The Foreigner. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the play before we get into talking about who the actors are and so forth?
Yeah, without giving out the whole thing, because we want people to show up and watch it. But it's two foreigners, like two fellows coming from England. And one fellow has been here before. He's in the Army, and he's bringing his friend Charlie Baker to the States because Charlie is downtrodden. He's not appreciated. He's in a drab job. And so they show up to Froggy's favorite spot in Tillman, Georgia. It's a lodge ran by Betty Meeks. But as they get there, Charlie decides that he doesn't want to stay. He just can't deal with people. And Froggy convinces him that he'll fix it for him, that he will fix it so that no one will speak to him. And what he does is he tells Betty that Charlie is a foreigner, which he is. He's from England, but that he doesn't speak a word of English. So don't even bother speaking to him. And that works really well for Charlie, except that Charlie's in the room and gets stuck in some very revealing conversations. And then Charlie uses those conversations to help better the situation. And his one dream is always to be interesting and to have a personality. And so that's Charlie's goal in this production.
Uh-huh. Well, tell us who are the major actors in the show.
I'll just give you two in order of appearance. It's easier that way. So
sure.
We have Bill Burkett, who is Froggy the Sword. He's Charlie Baker's friend. He's a demolition expert from Britain. He can talk the plan to protect Charlie from having to talk to the other guests. We have Dan Zabrowski, and Dan is Charlie Baker, Froggy's friend, and is a science fiction writer and an editor with an unfaithful wife. He has no personality that he's aware of and needs peace and quiet. His dream is to acquire a personality and to become interesting. Jean Kusol-Larsen, Betty Meeks, that's Froggy Lesore's friend. She's the owner of the lodge. She's an elderly widow who wishes she could have seen the world. And Betty is a good-hearted, down-home Southerner who speaks the local dialect. We got Eric Evenson. He's Reverend David Marshall Lee, Catherine Sims' fiancé, and David is a two-faced character. On one side of his face, he's a young reverend in love with Catherine. The other side is revealed as the play unfolds. We have Sidney LeBaron Fall, Catherine Sims, Ellard Sims' sister and David's fiancé. Catherine is a foreign debutante who discovers she is pregnant and is unsure how to deal with life. She has a sharp tongue and a keen wit to match. While David is away, she enjoys confiding in Charlie, who she believes does not understand a word she is saying. Stephen Michael Colley is Owen Musser, Reverend David Marshall Lee's friend, and as a property inspector and the poster child for an ill-bred Southern Klansman, Owen schemes to condemn Betty's Lodge so that it can be purchased below market for a reasonable price. And then we have Kevin Tharp, Ellard Sims, who is Catherine Sims' brother, and he's due to inherit his share of the Sims family fortune. He first appears to be a half-wit and a bit slow on the uptake until he gains confidence from teaching Charlie to speak English, which reveals Eller's true potential. So that's kind of the cast of shady characters in The Foreigner here.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, you acted in this play more than 20 years ago. Now you're directing it. Have you directed other shows in the meantime, or have you acted in other shows in the meantime?
Both. I have certainly acted in more shows than I've directed. I co-directed Miracle on 34th Street last year. My role in that was in charge of all the little children in the show. And I'm grateful that there aren't any children in this show because it's a handful to try and run roughshod over children. But I've done, I don't know, probably 15, 20 productions for the Theater Guild here.
Well, what's coming up for the Menominee Theater Guild for the rest of the season?
Well, The Foreigner opens on the 13th. After that, it's a Charlie Brown Christmas. And then there's a Company, which is a musical comedy, and then The Glass Menagerie. So that's the four shows that are coming up for the 2017-2018 season for MTG.
Mm-hmm. The play is The Foreigner. It will be staged by the Menominee Theater Guild Friday, October 13th through Sunday the 15th, and Friday the 20th through Sunday the 22nd. For ticket information, I always suggest you use your favorite internet search engine to find the Menominee Theater Guild. And we've been talking to the director, Bob Colson. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, I thank you so much. And I'd just like to say that, you know, I can remember the laughter from that 1992 production, and I've laughed out loud each and every day of rehearsal, even though I know exactly what's coming next and most of the lines by heart. So on behalf of the entire cast and crew, come out and enjoy the show.
That's the fun of community theater. Get out with a bunch of folks and have a good time.
Exactly.
Young Writers Read. News about an open mic for junior and senior high school ages. Coming up on Spectrum West. A week from Saturday, downtown River Falls will be home to a literary festival. A crawl, actually, where audience members can bounce from venue to hear writers recite, narrate, perform their work. Robin Bowles will be one of those people and now does double duty as the envoy between the event and potential attendees. That's you and me. This is the second annual. Is this a project of the Kinnickinnick Valley Writers Co-op?
Not per se. The two gals that I'm working on this with, Elise Gregory and Kate Maud, last year decided they wanted to create an outlet for writers in our community. Both of them are members of the writing group, but really they kind of took it on themselves and really made most of it happen. This year, we definitely have involvement from the writers group using people from that writing group to help. They'll be kind of our runners throughout the day, moving podiums, sure, easels to draw people's attention to where our location is next and that type of thing.
I always wondered if the plural of podiums was podia.
You know, you might be onto something there.
Yeah. So what do you know about the writers co-op? Do you know enough to tell us about it?
Yeah, I think I do. The year it was formulated, I'm thinking it's been about 5 years, maybe even a little longer. Mike Norman and Ron Newhouse, Dr. Mike Norman and Dr. Ron Newhouse, who are both retired professors from UWRF here, started the group. My understanding was to create a space that writers could come together and kind of move their work forward with the idea of eventually getting published. So creating a space where other writers could critique each other and give feedback that would be valuable to take their writing to the next level, tweak it to that point where they can submit it for publication.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cooperative. You know that people are working together.
When that word is used,
does the Writers Co-op sponsor other events?
We sponsored a literary reading in April of this year. We kind of paired it with Shakespeare's birthday and then did a reading event just at one location. The writers group has also been involved in bringing authors into River Falls and having a presentation at the library where that author talks about their book and then maybe some other kind of events surrounding that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that to me, the feeling is that the group now is shifting into looking at doing more of this type of thing, sponsoring events, creating space for writers to share their work, whether it's a literary reading or getting together with each other to do that more. But it seems to me like that's kind of a part of what's happening with this group, rather than just meeting and talking together once a month, trying to get that outreach into the community.
I remember the first time I heard that there was a Kinnickinnick River in River Falls after spending time in Milwaukee, where there's another Kinnickinnick River. Maybe it's the same one. I don't know. You know, it's such a unique name that you would think, somebody said, well, we can have two rivers named it.
That is interesting. You're sharing news with me. I didn't realize there was a Kinnickinnick River on the east side of the state. They say around here that we're kind of nationally known as this amazing trout fishing river.
Yeah, I'm not sure that a river in Milwaukee is good for trout.
Known for fishing.
But we'll have to see. And if not, we'll work on that.
There you go.
You do have a bunch of good writers in the River Falls area. I'm privileged to call Thomas Smith a friend.
Yes.
And as one might guess, because he seldom says no, I think he's handling some duties.
Can I interrupt you for one moment?
Oh, sure.
And we can get to this at the end, but we have unfortunately...
Uh-oh.
Thomas R. has discovered that he had a conflicting engagement.
Ah, well,
I know. So we will not have Thomas R. Smith emceeing our open mic.
So he does say no.
I know. We were shocked. I know he felt very bad about it.
Okay, so who's handling the job?
That will be Brian Mulrooney, who is a local poet. He's also a teacher. And maybe a bit of an unofficial apprentice to Thomas R. Smith.
Good Irishman?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so let's begin at the beginning, whether Thomas R. Smith is emceeing or not. First, tell me about people get a punch card.
Correct. And on that punch card, we list each of our locations. And as they attend each of the locations, they'll get a punch for that. And at the end of the day, if they come to the open mic, we're going to have a table of prizes. Each punch will get them a ticket to enter into the prize raffles. So if they go to three locations, they will get three tickets. They can put all three tickets into one jar for one prize to up their chances at that prize.
Sure.
Or they can spread them out and try for several prizes. The idea was to have literary prizes, you know, or something that's kind of in that vein. One of the things that I'm most excited about is we reached out to local writers in the area who have been published, and we have a stack of, I'd say, 15, at least at this point, 15 books published by local authors grouped into piles. You know, we've got a number of young adult books and some children's books and some adult books. So those will be raffled off. I think we'll divide them into three different sets. And then we've got a donation from the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson to their play Madagascar.
All right.
The Holler's Market in River Falls is donating. We're thinking either a bottle of wine or some coffee and chocolate, something to go with that literary experience. We're also soliciting some other downtown River Falls businesses to provide prizes. Fox Den Books is going to offer up a gift certificate that someone could win. So just trying to get prizes that will stick with that theme of, you know, of literary things.
Nice. We're getting details from our human wealth of information, Robin Bowles, details about the River Falls Lit Crawl, or that's short for
literary
crawl. It's in downtown River Falls, Saturday, October 14th, 11 a.m. to 5 and beyond, because the open mic, who knows how long that'll go. So it begins at 11 o'clock at the River Falls Library. That's when the young people, the student poets, do their thing. You have tutored them. You're looking forward to that. Then there's a break for lunch. And the schedule reminds me of my high school system. 50-minute classes and then 10 minutes to get to the next one.
Exactly.
It's kind of interesting. Students are doing some things, as I alluded in that first session, that also includes River Falls Schools and UWRF. The Falcons have their event a bit later. So next, at 1 o'clock, Gallery 120, local and regional writers. You have a trio, it says on what I'm looking at. What is each writer's specialty?
Dan Wohl writes suspense books, but they also are set in the natural world.
Okay.
And he really kind of embraces that kind of adventure, suspense, thriller kind of writing.
Okay.
Then we have Janine Olet. Her first novel is currently in her agent's hands. She just finished it up and is hoping that that will go out. But she's published several short stories in literary journals, and she's been a runner-up for the Pushcart Prize. So she is from Minneapolis. And then we have David Wood, who is a local River Falls character is what I want to say. He's been a college professor. He wrote for the Star Tribune, doing book reviews. Just brings a lot of color to our community. He also writes a weekly column in our local newspaper, the River Falls Journal. And he's published several short story collections and essay collections, memoir stuff. So he'll be sharing some of that with us.
All right. And then at 2 o'clock at Riverwalk Square, UW River Falls, past and present, we could name names. Professor Emeritus Michael Norman is there, UWRF student writers. That says TBA. How many are there going to be? Do you know yet?
We believe there will be three.
Okay.
But we have not yet received any names.
All right. And Professor Emeritus Margarita Hendrickson reading there. You correct me if you've made additions since...
Nope, you are right on track so far.
At 3 o'clock... Kinney Clay, what a cool name. The Writer Co-op gets their spotlight there, and that's where you and four of your good friends are going to be.
Correct.
It's Miriam King, Kay Lee Penton, Allison Reimers, Leslie Thomas, and our own Robin Bowles. That's at 3 o'clock. Kinney Clay, that's on Main Street. And then it's 4 o'clock, Juniors, open
Correct.
Mic. This might run over a little bit.
The open mic, yeah, and we've kind of got it loosely scheduled, so if people want to keep reading, we're going to keep going.
So you're inviting people to bring, 5 to 10 minutes worth of material to share?
Correct.
Again, our MC is going to be...
Brian Mulrooney.
Now, you mentioned prizes already, and you gave us a laundry list. I'm sure you want to thank people who have donated those prizes.
Definitely lots of authors have donated books. We've also would like to thank the Holler's Market in River Falls, and Fox Den Books, also located in River Falls, the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson.
All right.
And Chapter 2 Books in Hudson as well has also offered some book prizes.
And kudos to the River Falls Optimist Club.
We are so grateful for their support. They gave us a monetary amount that we could use, which has been wonderful for getting flyers and punch cards and lining up our microphones and also providing some rewards for the kids who are writing poetry, that we're going to give them each a gift certificate.
In all the towns I've been in my life, there's never been a pessimist club.
They're usually not chartered, probably.
They're probably some unofficial ones.
Exactly.
Yes. It's called the second annual River Falls Literary Crawl. It's Saturday, October 14th, begins at 11 at the River Falls Public Library, then moves on to four other venues, ends up at Junior's Restaurant and Tap House for an open mic. Robin, let's say that someone listening did not get enough information even now. How do they get more on their own?
They could check out our Facebook page, the River Falls Lit Crawl. We're updating posts regularly with author bios, venue information, and just kind of doing a general countdown to the event. So I would say Facebook would be the best place to find out more information. They could also check in with the venues as well.
Robin Bowles, your participation is appreciated. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota with the all-wheel drive RAV4, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or MarquardtToyota.com. Jim Oliver takes the pulse of theater companies around western Wisconsin. Let's catch him before he leaves the house.
Thank you, sir. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present the musical Sister Act Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Clear Lake Community Theater will present The Curious Savage Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Clear Lake Area Community Center. The Beverly Hillbillies will be staged by the Neillsville Area Players October 13th to the 15th and the 21st and 22nd at the Neillsville High School. The Foreigner will be staged by the Menominee Theater Guild October 13th to the 15th and the 20th to the 22nd at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The St. Croix Art Barn of Osceola will stage Love Letters Friday and Saturday and October 13th and 14th. Pride and Prejudice will be staged by the Barron Spotlighters Thursday through Saturday at the Barron Area Community Center. Theater in the Woods of Shell Lake will stage Death by Design October 12th to the 15th and the 19th to the 22nd at the Erica Quam Theater. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond will stage Johnny Appleseed Weekdays for Groups continuing to October 20th. And Come Blow Your Horn will continue weekends through October 28th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. I'm Jim Oliver.
Max Garland has taught our young people, written and shared poetry and other forms of significant literature, personified literature's lofty place in Wisconsin as our poet laureate, and for a while yet assumes the responsibility of Eau Claire's writer-in-residence. He's delegated organizer for a monthly Writer's Read event coming up. This one's special, given its presenters. But you know, you can't sit down with Max Garland and chin wag about just one thing. No, certainly you can't. Writer in residence, how's that coming along? Are you able to leave the residence now and again?
I do, but it's a pretty busy.
Is there a term to writer in residence, or are you just it forever?
Oh, 2 years, and so I'm going to be in this position until the end of April.
Okay.
And then I'll happily pass it on to the next person.
I had a chance earlier this year to talk to Carla Houston, the current poet laureate of Wisconsin.
Yes.
She was interesting and delightful.
Absolutely.
Do you ever get to hang out with other poets laureate? Is there kind of a fraternity or what?
It's not really a fraternity, but over the course of time, yes, we've read together. And as a matter of fact, Carla and I are reading together the Chippewa Valley Book Festival October 20th at the Unitarian Congregation here at 4 o'clock. And we're going to read poems about memory. And I think the event is called The Poetry of Memory.
Anything physical that's handed over when you relinquish the title of poet laureate, like the green jacket at the Masters Golf Tournament or the poet laureate keyboard?
There's a very elaborate gown that we wear. That, as you can see, I'm wearing it right
yes,
now.
Yes, you are.
It's a silk deal.
Wish the people listening
deal.
Could see
and,
it. Yeah. Earlier on, when you were poet laureate of the state of Wisconsin, we talked about a poet laureate handshake. You said at the time there wasn't one, but you thought you might develop one. Is that...
It's very subtle. You may have encountered it without even knowing.
We didn't shake hands today, so maybe I...
That's how subtle it is.
Well, but you couldn't shake hands with me that way anyway, because I'm not a poet laureate. I think that's saved just for for the laureates,
yeah,
right?
I think that's the case. I'll have to go back and look at the documents.
The Writer's Read program has been going on for a while. Is overseeing that program part of the Writers in Residence job description?
Yes, and we have Bruce Taylor to thank for initiating this some time ago and ran it for a while. But I happily took it over, and so once a month, the second Thursday of every month, there's some kind of reading at the public library here. Sometimes it's an open mic. Often it's an open mic. Often there's a theme that people are invited to come and read. I think you've attended one of these before.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the next one is a teen open mic, which we have once a year. And this one is for writers from grades 7 to 12, and that's Thursday on October 12th. That's what I'm looking forward to.
I'll bet. You've had some, to backtrack a bit, some interesting themes for some of these nights in the past. Refresh my memory since you've taken over.
Two of them I liked a lot that I think generate a lot of interest. One was the inaugural reading in which I invited people in our community to come. It was during the week of the presidential inauguration, the last one, and read the poem they would read if they were reading the inaugural poem at the inauguration of our current president. Then many people wrote their own inaugural poems and delivered these addresses just as if they were reading them to the nation.
I'm sorry I missed that one.
It was quite interesting. Another one was poems from seven nations, and people were invited to bring poems from the seven nations that at that time were being banned in terms of, of traveling into this country. People brought poems from Syria and Somalia and Iraq, Iran. That was quite moving and I think generated a lot of energy and sort of opened up the world of poetry to us a little bit more profoundly.
The Writer's Read coming up in October, as you said, is an open mic for the next generation of writers. You're a former educator, or maybe once an educator, always an educator. What's the difference between what young people write and what us seasoned individuals tend to compose? Is there a difference? Is there a freshness to what young people write?
I think there's a potential freshness to that. I think that if you really look back at notable writers, many of them wrote their first things when they were teenagers. Emily Dickinson's first poems were published. Well, she had very few poems published, but the first poems we know about were written just after her teen years. John Keats was writing things. Bob Dylan was writing things. Yeah. One of my favorite poets, Wilfred Owen, one of the great World War I poet, he was just 20, I think, when he wrote one of the greatest war poems in history. And so I think there's a lot of creativity. I think the same things, many of the same things that motivate older writers are happening inside of younger people. Doubts, fears, joys, expectations, mysteries, and most of all, things that they wish they could say but have a hard time saying. Very often, there's a sense of not really being listened to. That might be a little bit of a difference. And so using the avenue of poetry sometimes can be a great source for the voice that resides inside young people, but often is somewhat stifled.
Are there things that start to show in a person's writing as they age? Cynicism or wisdom or resignation or acceptance?
That often happens. I don't think it has to happen.
But wisdom would be a good one.
Well, wisdom would be a good one. Yes. Yeah, perspective.
Sure.
I was talking about Thoreau the other day to some people. Of course, Henry David Thoreau didn't live that long. He died at 44. But one of the things you notice when you read his writing, though it changed a bit, his optimism and his openness and his curiosity did sort of continually renew itself. And I think ideally that's what would happen. The two things about young people's writing that is of interest to me is, first of all, a lot of young people feel they're the only ones who ever felt the way they feel, who ever had the doubts, who ever felt the alienations, who ever felt no one understands me, I have these strange thoughts, you know, and they feel kind of trapped inside that. I did at that age. And writing, reading, hearing others read can let you know that you're not alone. That is also true for people later in life. But maybe the biggest thing right now that I think is important about inviting young people up to the microphone and listening to them and encourage them is those of us who are supposed to have that perspective that we talked about, those of us who are supposed to be grown up, who are posing as grown-ups, aren't doing such a great job. I think there are things too important that are going on in the world to leave it to adults to handle. I don't think our record is all that great right now, and I don't think what is being articulated by people in the highest levels of leadership are anything our youngest writers should emulate. In fact, I think we need their voices. And so I think that's quite important. We need that freshness.
So maybe one of those words I should have come up with would be complacency.
That could be complacency. And it could be that the voices of youth, the voices of hope, the voices that are not cynical are exactly what we need to listen to as adults.
Max Garland with us, Eau Claire writer in residence, former Wisconsin poet laureate. Writers Read, the monthly program that comes up at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire, happens on the 12th of October, 6 p.m. This is for grades 7 through 12. It's a given that what we read and what we enjoy reading is as individual as what we pick out from a restaurant menu. And yet there are masters out there, guys and gals perceived as master writers, people who are up on this upper echelon. Why are they there? What makes a great writer? Why are the Thoreaus up there? Is it how they write? Is it what they write about? Did they have a good PR firm? What?
You just asked me a question that would take several weeks to answer, and we would need a panel of smarter people than I am.
Well, someday we'll do a whole show on
because that. Because that would be an interesting show. I'm not really making the claim for anyone else in terms of Thoreau. Thoreau is someone I read when I was young. He made me think about the world I lived in a different way. He made me feel differently about the natural world. He is one of the ones that I read now many decades later that still seems relevant to me. Okay. Here is this person who removed himself for a short time from the busyness of the world and yet never removed himself from the concerns of the world. Someone who saw things that were very wrong, slavery, expansionist war, and decided even from his small platform he could speak out against those things.
Okay. So relevance and shelf life could be criteria of a master writer, an icon.
There's a lot of cultural movements that, you know, either suppress writing that we later discover is of great value or illuminate writers. How did we neglect these people?
I guess the only reason I brought him up is because there does seem to be a certain number of people who are mentioned all the time. They are the people who are read in English classes.
But if you look at this,
The Carl Sandburgs, they're just always in our consciousness as far as the literary world goes.
Right, but those things change with time, and they should change with time. Here's a trajectory that I've noticed. We often tend to ignore writers, maybe not take them quite seriously when they're alive. We then perhaps elevate and perhaps idealize. And then in our culture, we tend to tear the heroes back down, bring them back down to size. We deflate or deconstruct them. And so that is something that I've seen happen with a lot of so-called great writers. The people who were revered mostly in Thoreau's day, we don't hear much about right now. He was not among the most well-known writers nationally or international at the time he lived. He once wrote, "I have a library of 900 volumes, 700 of which I wrote myself." In other words, the books he couldn't sell. And so those things change with time.
Could also be that he had three names. That makes you kind of stately. You could be Maximilian something Garland, couldn't you?
Here's what happens. Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, that's a regular sounding name.
Had something to say that people around her were not ready or able to hear. Thoreau had something to say that speaks to us, I think, more than it spoke to the people around him at the time.
I'm glad I asked. So back to the young people. How important is it for a young person to believe in their work enough to get up and read or recite it in front of an audience?
I wish I had believed in my words enough. I wished I had had nerve enough, and I wish there had been venues, frankly.
You're making up for that now.
Well,
good for you.
A lot of people are. The idea of the open mic, the idea of spoken word, the invitation to younger people to say what's inside them is more available now, and it's more frequent now than it was in times past. You don't have to shut up until you're dead and then be heard. You can be heard now. And that if you think of something, if something bothers you, if something motivates you, if something is intense inside of you, you have a right to say it. and you speak up. Maybe later you'll look back upon it and you'll think maybe that wasn't as profound. But you have to say a lot of things that aren't profound in order to finally say the thing that is.
Wow. Good way of saying it. So don't be too critical of your work if you're a young person. Test it.
Give yourself permission. I'm visiting a couple more classes. I visited a high school class over at Memorial the other day and listened to the students there and talked to them about poetry. And it was like the best experience I've had in a long time.
Good
looking
for you.
At young people and looking at people in a classroom who felt like, oh, here's a writer who came. This is a poet. Because what I remember, I might have told you this before, but I never knew there were living poets when I was in high school. I thought you had to be dead. I thought you had to be as dead as a Greek statue to ever make it as a poet. And I didn't know you could be that. Poets just don't have to come from elevated places and come from far away and exotic locales.
Yeah.
The best art, music, poetry, fiction, nonfiction can come from your neighborhood.
It's Teen Open Mic, Thursday night, October 12th, beginning at 6 p.m., L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. Everybody, grades 7 through 12, if you like to write, bring your stuff. We'll make this run over. You're not going to be able to end this at whatever time it is that you normally end, because I have a feeling there's going to be a nice turnout. Max Garland, thanks.
Thank you.
Always delightful to converse with that gentleman, and all our guests, of course. Some Spectrum memoranda for you. Native American flutist Peter Phippen's music has again received some impressive nominations. We'll be talking with Peter in coming weeks. You can hear him tonight, if you're listening Thursday, at the Acoustic Cafe in Eau Claire, 7 p.m. Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls brings you Dueling Dummies, comedy, voice-tossing, storytelling, music with David Malmberg. That's Friday evening at 7:30. The exhibit at the Heidi is Hugh Mondelaer Retrospective, Art and Addiction, through October 27th. The website there is cvca.net. At the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory, an original art exhibit, Painting as Prayer, artwork by Sister Christine Hagen. Opening with a Friday evening event, 7:30 p.m., northernlakecenter.org. Saturday, Brio Brass performs at the Phipps Center in Hudson. It's pop of every era. The Phipps.org is the website there. And don't forget, this is the weekend of the 18th Fresh Art Fall Tour. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. 17 studios and galleries in Pierce and Pepin counties. Everything you need to know and want to know is online at freshart.org. Next week, we'll see what she's up to. Comedian Mary Mack, that is. Jim Oliver begins coverage of the 18th Chippewa Valley Book Festival. A new season begins for the Marvelous Master Singers and more, as you know. Thanks, Becca, Kate, and Dean, for all you do. Thank you guys out there for all you're willing to do, like listen to WPR and Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. See you next week.